On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Momentous days before the Supreme Court this week. More Trayvon Martin furor, an open mic budget battle, and a JetBlue freakout. It sounded like rough sledding for the Obama health care reforms before the Supreme Court. Justice Anthony Kennedy, the supposed swing vote, saw a fundamental change in the reforms.
Well, that changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way.
Competing narratives battled over Trayvon Martin and his killer, George Zimmerman. In police video, Zimmerman looked unscratched. The Martin attorney pounced.
There is no evidence from that video that he beat his head against the concrete. There is no visible evidence that his nose is broken. How long is it going to take for them to be arrested?
And JetBlue Flight 191 from New York to Los Angeles was a zoo. Flight Captain Clayton Osbon totally lost it, had to be restrained by passengers. Here's the captain.
No, we got Israel. Our zoo is destroyed. No, we got Israel, we got Iraq
to Las Vegas, I should have said there. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Brian Monroe of CNN, Louise Rodnovsky of the Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Have you been following the Supreme Court this week? Will the health care law stand? Should it? And what are you thinking on Trayvon Martin budget battle? JetBlue, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Louise Rodnovsky. She's health policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She's been busy. Louise, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Brian Monroe, also with us from Washington, editor of CNNpolitics.com. Brian, great to have you back.
Always great to be with you, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Louise, and Brian.
So here we are. What a week with the Supreme Court. Americans really got an eyeful outside, an earful from inside, plus all those jazzy sketches we saw of the attorneys arguing before the court. Louise, today they're voting. What does this vote mean? This is just the justices. It's not binding, as I understand. They can change it any time until it comes out late in June. But what, are they sitting in one room today, Louise, and sort of telling each other what they think?
Apparently that's how it works. Of course, none of us are going to see it, and we're all going to spend the next 3 months wondering and waiting. And then after that, the numerous possibilities that could arise from whatever they decide are going to be things that we're going to be grappling with for the rest of the year. So today's the day, but nothing's happening that we can do anything about.
Vice President Biden, Louise, has been out saying, they're going to sign off on it, everything's fine, here it goes. What's your sense after watching so closely these arguments for the better part of a week?
Well, that's something that the Obama administration has been saying for a long time, and they've denied that they have any contingency plans in place for what they would do if the court were to strike down part of the law, for example, or indeed all of it. And so they've been maintaining this public air of confidence about it. It's not clear whether behind the scenes there are, in fact, plans going on, but certainly for other folks who would be affected by this in health systems, there's a lot of planning going on, especially in the insurance industry, where they're starting to coalesce around some alternatives that they might try to enforce. Of course, their problem there is that Congress is unlikely to take any action for the rest of this year and possibly, depending on who's elected in November, any action next year. So there's a lot of unknowns beyond the Supreme Court unknown. There's the political campaign unknown and the legislative one.
Millions and millions of people's health and fates and liberty, as it's argued before the court, in the balance this week. Brian Monroe, what were you thinking as you listened to these hearings and arguments along with much of the country this week? I'm just curious, for somebody who's so deep in the political world, looking over here into the court and how they're dealing with this highly charged political and fundamental issue of health, what were you hearing? What did you think?
Well, it was clear almost from the first moment of testimony that the Obama administration was in deep trouble. The individual mandate was under fire, and even some of the more moderate judges were questioning whether it was allowable and constitutional. So I think it's all but, and you hate to say this after only 3 days of oral arguments, but it's all but clear that the mandate is going to be the linchpin and may go under. And that leaves a question, so what's left with the law itself? And is it gutted? Is it hollow? Can it still stand? You can even make the argument from a political standpoint that maybe having the court rule against the Obama administration might actually be good for the Democrats in the political season. It may actually galvanize their base to come out and vote in a base that has been sort of lukewarm right now. So, you know, it's wait and see, but I think the mandate's in big trouble.
Maybe it feels like that could go either way. Maybe galvanize the base. On the other hand, here stands a president with his major accomplishment from his first term. If the Supreme Court strikes it down, just kind of swept away. LA Times saying here, Supreme Court appeared ready to strike down not just the requirement that individuals have insurance, but the entire law, invalidating a major piece of domestic legislation for the first time since the Depression. That's a long stretch, and we've got a court here that hasn't been afraid, whether it's in Bush v. Gore or in Citizens United or now in the health care case, to get in. Here's a little sound from the court. This was on Tuesday when the individual mandate was on the floor being talked about. Sympathetic Justice Stephen Breyer seemed to suggest that just being alive might qualify a person as being in the health care market.
When you are born and you don't have insurance and you will, in fact, get sick, and you will, in fact, impose costs. Have you, perhaps involuntarily, perhaps simply because you are a human being, entered this particular market, which is a market for health care?
Well, there you go. But Justice Antonin Scalia not friendly toward this and saying, how far would the government go here? How much can it affirmatively require citizens to do when it comes to commerce? Could it get into their food choices? Could it require them to buy broccoli?
Could you define the market? Everybody has to buy food sooner or later. So you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
Jack Beatty, everybody's in the market from the moment of birth. On the other hand, then this notion of government so powerful that it could reach down and require you to buy broccoli. And here we are with the health care of millions and millions, ultimately all Americans, standing right beneath this argument.
Yes, and I thought the polls showed that something like 70% of us think that politics will decide this, not constitutional logic or precedent. And listening to the arguments, that certainly reinforced that impression. The liberals were trying to help the government, and the conservatives were critical. The only ambivalent justice on either side seemed to be Justice Kennedy, who seemed to be genuinely torn between his vision of liberty as being, impeded by that young man, as he put it, being forced into commerce, buying something he doesn't want, this insurance policy, versus he saw the other side. Isn't that person already almost implicitly in commerce because his abstention from the market raises the costs of everyone else's insurance because it doesn't share the risk? He seemed genuinely torn. The other justices lined up according to their political or, to be fair, their judicial predispositions.
Of course, and then we had the attorneys arguing their hearts out for the sympathies here. Paul Clement against the Solicitor General Donald Verrilli for the Obama administration. And Justice Kennedy with this notion of what is liberty? What liberty really matters here? Paul Clement saying, hey, being forced to buy something, does that sound like liberty? On the other hand, here was the Solicitor General saying, look, there's a health care in its own way provides an important freedom for all. Here's Donald Verrilli.
There will be millions of people with chronic conditions like diabetes and heart disease. And as a result of the health care that they will get, they will be unshackled from the disabilities that those diseases put on them and have the opportunity to enjoy the blessings of liberty. And the same thing will be true for a husband whose wife is diagnosed with breast cancer and who won't face the prospect of being forced into bankruptcy to try to get care for his wife and the face the risk of having to raise his children alone, and I could multiply example after example after example.
And we heard a lot in 3 days of testimony and a historic volume of testimony, argumentation put right before the country. Justice Ginsburg, Louise, talked about, said, hey, are we here for a wrecking operation to sort of bring the whole thing down or a salvage operation? Is it clear that the court can get in here, declare significant pieces of this unconstitutional and yet leave it standing? Or does it, as Justice Scalia kind of suggested, does it all come down?
Well, this is the issue that was preoccupying the court on Wednesday morning. And the case law on this is that the court should be careful in how much it decides to void the rest of an otherwise constitutional statute if they go after one particular part of it. But what's making this so complicated and what's preoccupying the justices is quite how complex the health overhaul law was in the first place. And mm-hmm. if you remember, and if you don't, Republicans will remind you of it, mm-hmm. it's thousands of pages long, depending on how you count it. It's very complex. And there are a number of provisions in it which are linked to varying degrees, and there are a number of provisions in it that aren't linked at all, really, except that they were attached to this bill. And so the question is really a couple of things. One of the things the justices are very interested in is whether or not provisions like the black lung payment reauthorization or what Justice Breyer refers to as the Indian stuff, he's referring to health expansion services for Native Americans, whether or not those would have passed at all had the mandate and the rest of the bill not been going through, or indeed if they were, as some of the other justices have argued, thrown in as sweeteners to get support for the mandate, which is less popular. So there's a really complicated issue about how the legislation itself came together, and that's what the justices are considering, and it's really not clear where they're going to go.
Jack Beattie, Louise says case law says be careful, but I mean, it was just a week before these arguments that I think something like 8 out of 10 of legal scholars were saying there's no question that they'll sign off on this. The precedent is all there for them to sign off on this, decades of precedent. But this is a court that has not necessarily been bound by that kind of precedent, Jack.
No, it hasn't. A study, and it's an increasingly conservative court. A study by Richard Posner, the distinguished conservative jurist, found that four of the six most conservative justices who served since 1937 are now on the court. Four of the six, and Justice Kennedy is in the top 10 most conservative ideologically.
And they've got
that
all this
really
before them right now. Jack, stand by there. Louise Radnofsky, Brian Moore, it's great to have you. We're looking at a week in the news. Listeners, what's your verdict on Supreme Court sessions this week? Is this giant reform going down? Should it? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Healthcare before the high court. Budget talk on Capitol Hill. The Trayvon Martin story grows. JetBlue freak out. You can join the conversation. What's your verdict on the Supreme Court sessions this week? Were you impressed by the quality of the justices' questions, the arguments there? And how will all this impact our future, the fall election? And what's happening with the Trayvon Martin story? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Brian Monroe joins us from CNNPolitics.com, editor there. Louise Radnofsky covers health policy for the Wall Street Journal. She's with us from Washington. Our own Jack Beattie's here. It seemed like everybody was in Washington this week. Rick Santorum was there, right there on Monday, on the steps of the Supreme Court. While they argued inside, he criticized his opponent Mitt Romney's record on health care, said that he, Santorum, would work to repeal Obama's health care law.
All he says was, I'll repeal Obamacare, and in the same breath, he defends Obamacare at the state level. It just doesn't wash, and it won't wash in the general election, and that's why if you really want Obamacare repealed, if you really want Obamacare repealed, there's only one person who can make that happen, and that's someone who makes Obamacare the central issue in this race, and that's what I do.
Rick Santorum may not have to repeal it if the Supreme Court strikes it down. Sean in New Haven, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I guess my question was, did anyone bring up the idea of the market being Social Security and that everybody is required to buy into Social Security, but nobody's trying to repeal that? And I wanted to know if what the justices said about the idea of comparing the Individual Mandate Act to Social Security.
Let's pick it up. Louise, what about the Social Security parallel, or is it parallel? Did the court look at that?
The Social Security parallel came up a couple of times. Actually, interestingly, at the very beginning of the case, in the first issue that the justices were considering, which is whether or not they should even be hearing this case, there is an argument that there's a 19th century law that requires people to pay their taxes or their fines before they can challenge them in court. The question is whether the mandate is a tax for the purposes of applying that act. What Chief Justice Roberts said, then going on to indicate that over the course of the next 3 days he could go either way on a number of different issues, was that the government had waived its rights to stall a challenge back in 1937 over Social Security, and that was probably something that the court had upheld at the time.
But I think our caller Louise is looking at a bigger. I think our caller is looking at a bigger issue, not what happened in 1930, but whether there's a parallel in Social Security itself to the kind of requirement here. That you buy into health care so that you're covered. You buy into Social Security so that you can retire. Was it put just that way? Do they look parallel to you?
We heard a lot more about broccoli than we did about Social Security over 3 days. But certainly there is that parallel there. What the justices are considering is whether the federal government has the power to mandate people to purchase a product. And that's really the heart of the case that the challengers are bringing. They see health insurance as a product. What the defenders of the law are saying is that health care itself is something that people experience just by being in the world, and health insurance simply happens to be the product that enables them to experience health care. And of course, depending on which side of the case you're coming at, you're arguing about insurance versus health care. It's actually sort of a fundamental disconnect there, and you can see in the judges that too.
Jack, this
but
issue.
Even politically,
yes.
Even politically, right. You look at the history of Social Security, and it did not go through its first time back in the 30s and 40s. In fact, I think there was a Supreme Court challenge to a piece of the original Roosevelt's New Deal legislation that was challenged. So it did not have a smooth sailing when it first launched either.
I mean, Jack, this is interesting. If you the argument we heard from conservative justices was, how can you push American citizens into commerce? And that's because the Obama administration kind of trying to split the difference here, you know, saying we're going to try and get health care for everybody, but we're going to do it through the private market and private health insurance companies. So if they just went to make it a tax like a Social Security tax and pushed people into a universal health care system, it seemed that the court would be saying, well, that we've already done.
Yes, the taxing power moors Social Security in a way that the Commerce Clause does not, at least according to some of the conservative justices, moor this particular act. You know, this gets right back to the debate in the Congress. This came up. Should we do this? Should we call this a tax? Should we administer this as a tax? And Democrats said, if we do that, we will be clobbered at the polls. We cannot come forward as a tax party. And this shows, even at its most liberal and progressive, which was that moment, really, the biggest moment since Medicare, the Democratic Party was still under the shadow of Ronald Reagan, still petrified of being accused as the party of tax and spend.
Well, and of course, this week, Republicans pushing back on tax with the budget from Paul Ryan. We'll look at that. Lisa in Phoenix City, Alabama. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Taking my call. Mm-hmm. The reason that I'm actually hoping that they strike down the individual mandate is, as a small business owner, I would no longer be forced to pay for insurance for all of my 54 employees all year. So if the individual mandate is struck down, then as a small business owner, I don't have to continue to pay the $1,500 per month per employee.
Lisa, stand by. Louise Rudnowski, help us here. Is that the way the law is set up now? As a small business owner, does the individual mandate make the difference of whether Lisa, as an employer, is going to be paying for all of her 50 employees' health care or not?
Lisa makes a really good point, and stay with me here because it's a tiny bit complicated, but there are a number of provisions in the law. The individual mandate is the one that has a lot of the attention precisely because it's the focus of the constitutional challenge, but there's also a mandate that employers with more than 50 workers, so her 54 squarely puts her in that category, will, after 2014, the same point at which the individual mandate takes effect, have to provide insurance for their employees. And so what the challengers in the case, including the NFIB that have brought it,
so
are trying to do
is the National Federation for Business or something.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Federation for Independent Business, exactly. Mm-hmm. What they're hoping to do is, by challenging the individual mandate, take down the rest of the law, sort of like a Jenga tower.
Mm-hmm.
But that depends on the severability part of the case, whether or not justices decide to strike down the entire law after they've decided, hypothetically, to strike down the mandate. And it's not clear whether or not that they're going to do that. So that's one of the number of unknown scenarios here.
Lisa, in Alabama, let me ask you then, as an employer, you've got 50-some employees there, presumably at some level, whether it's moral or just, in operating terms, their health matters to you. If we don't do it this way, how would you like to see health care get to people, the tens of millions who don't have it in this country, Lisa?
I believe that you should be able to pay for it on your own. I don't think it should be forced either through your employer or through the government to purchase it. I have always had insurance. I either went to a company that offered it or I paid for it myself. And it just seems to me that we're getting to a point where we're dictating what people can and cannot have, and we're taking away the personal responsibilities of those people who are almost to the point where they feel that they are obligated to be given certain benefits, even if it's just a part-time landscaping job.
Lisa, we've got it. If you need it, go get it. Of course, we know the arguments on the other side of that, but that's a very clear position. Philip in Bath, New Hampshire, thanks for calling. Lisa, thanks to you. Philip, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess what a point I'd like to make is that the argument in front of the court was, should someone be forced to buy health insurance? And, you know, I feel that it should be flipped over. And, you know, why am I, as a person with health insurance, being forced to subsidize people without health insurance?
And so what? Bring on the individual mandate, because then everybody's in the pool and you're not subsidizing those who don't have it, Philip, is your view?
Exactly. I mean, we're paying for it now because people get, if they need health care and they go to the emergency room, they get it. And I think out of the 50 million odd people that don't have health care, that, you know, they'd jump at the chance to be able to get affordable health care, that there'd be a very small minority who'd say, I don't want it.
Yeah, we'll see in June exactly how the court rules here. Brian Monroe, how do you see the politics of this playing out? I mean, you hear two perspectives there from Lisa in Alabama, from Phil in New Hampshire. They're kind of coming from opposite ends of this thing, and people are going to resonate one way or the other or somewhere in between. Does this end up, I don't know, does it hurt the GOP presidential candidates? Because if the Supreme Court strikes it down, it takes away a big issue that Rick Santorum certainly wants to make much of, or some other way.
Well, you know, it's certainly, you can make that argument. First of all, losing on health care is a big blow to the administration. No doubt about it. It was his signature event, signature legislation, and losing that. That said, this has been the argument for the Republicans, both arguing against Mitt Romney, who introduced it in Massachusetts, or many of the candidates who have since dropped out, Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, others who have gone after what they call Obamacare. So taking this off the table, unfortunately, there are plenty of other issues they can go after the president on. So I think they'll be okay. But going back to the caller's original question about, as a small business, that it lets her off the hook for paying the $1,500 or so for her employees. If we look at the median U.S. income, what, around $45,000, $50,000, you take taxes out of that, take home is what, around $35,000 or so? $1,500 a month for a family of four to pay for health care. That's half of that take home right there, before they paid rent, before they bought food, before they put gas in the car.
But of course, there are subsidies built into the health care reform all the way up to, what is it, three or four times the poverty level.
Exactly. But again, this gets back to the argument of severability. If they strike down the mandate piece of it, is the rest of the law still stand? And that's what they spent most of the last day of arguments looking at, is whether there's any pieces of the health care bill, or actually health care law, whether it's coverage for older students or any of the other provisions that many in both parties agree to, whether any of those can stand at all once they strike it all down.
Jack, I'm trying to imagine President Obama on the stump later in the summer, if this has been struck down at that point by the Supreme Court, and the position he takes on it at that point. Is he a kind of martyr to what should have been? Does he say, we've got another plan, you know, elect me again and we'll go in another way? How on earth does he handle that, if that's the way it should go?
Well, I mean, it strengthens the Republican narrative that he has overreached, that this is a president who wants to expand the scope of the government. So it puts him on the defensive there just very clearly. The White House, at least the speculation I've seen, is that they will run against the court, that the president will run to Americans saying, look, I had a plan that would get everybody, or most everybody, halve the number of the uninsured, which would help lower rates for everybody because of this cost-shifting problem that Philip alluded to. I've done that, and this court, in an ideological political judgment, has struck this down, throwing over 70 years of seeming precedent on the Commerce Clause. And I'm telling you folks, appointing the right people to that court is what this election is all about. If we want to have, this is what President Roosevelt did in 1936. You know, we have to have the right people on the court to make my program work. So he can at the same time he's running against the Congress playing Harry Truman, he can run against the court playing FDR. Whether it will work, we don't know.
Louise,
and it seems that most of America agrees with you. We did the CNN poll this week that showed that half of those polled said that this judgment will be made based on political views, not objective interpretations of the law. So I think America is listening to you.
Well, that's disturbing if that's the way it is on the court front. Of course, there may be people who just don't like the way the court is leaning, but that comes back to Jack's point. It is clearer than ever how much it matters who gets appointed to this court. Louise, if this health care reform should more or less in toto come crashing down out of a Supreme Court ruling here, how does health care change come back? In what guise? I mean, what are the options here? If it's not this, what and when could you imagine being resurrected? We've got tens of millions of people without coverage.
Well, there's another poll that's worth bearing in mind, and it's the one that's conducted by the Kaiser Family Foundation and tracks monthly how people feel about the law. And what's interesting about that poll and remains interesting about that poll is that many of the individual provisions of the health law are popular. Many of them. In fact, almost all of them. The one that isn't popular is the requirement that people purchase insurance or pay a fee. Guaranteed issue to people regardless of their medical history is. So there's clearly huge demand and huge support for many of the individual provisions. Now, when it's packaged as a law, that's really complicated. As to what will happen next, that entirely depends on what happens in the November elections. And if Republicans are controlling Congress after them, or indeed controlling Congress in the White House, then that would obviously lead to a very different scenario than
but
than
like
if it
what?
Were
Do they have a
Democrats.
Plan? Do they have a plan for getting coverage to most Americans? I honestly don't know.
They have a number of plans, is the short answer. There are various Republicans and conservative think tanks that are circulating ideas, but there is certainly no consensus on them. And the question would be at what point they would start to decide that they had to coalesce around certain ideas. Clearly, they've looked at Democrats and the experience that Democrats had passing health reform and know that, it might be something that you want to get agreement on sooner rather than later. Otherwise, it can get very, very nasty and prolong an otherwise very nasty battle.
We're looking at a big week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Running behind and through everything this week, the Trayvon Martin story continues to evolve. All kinds of material coming to the fore this week. Part of it about Trayvon Martin's own suspensions and the reasons for those. They were not all flattering. His parents were not happy with that material having been made public. Here was his father, Tracy Martin, on NPR's Tell Me More. This was on Wednesday, dismissing the recently publicized school suspension and other disciplinary problems.
That was put out there just to lose focus on what was really happening, which was there was a murder. And it was just an attempt to assassinate his character. We're not saying that Trayvon was perfect, but what we are saying is he was our child. He was our child. He was a good kid, and he didn't deserve death.
Wasn't perfect, didn't deserve death, said the father of Trayvon Martin. Here was the brother of George Zimmerman. This is Robert Zimmerman Jr. last night on CNN's Piers Morgan. Tonight, saying his brother was acting strictly in self-defense on the night of the shooting.
Nobody just stood there with a bag of Skittles and an iced tea. If you return force with force when somebody assaults you, George was out of breath. He was barely conscious. His last thing he remembers doing was moving his head from the concrete to the grass so that if he was banged one more time, he wouldn't be, wearing diapers for the rest of his life and being spoon-fed by his brother. And there would have been George dead had he not acted decisively and instantaneously in that moment when he was being disarmed.
Of course, it's Martin that's dead, but Brian Monroe, we've got very different narratives emerging this week, and here's the one that's coming from the Zimmerman side saying assaulted by young Trayvon Martin. And then we saw the video of him going into the police station, and we don't know what was there however many minutes before he was on the ground, but you couldn't see blood in that video on the back of his head, nor could you see, a broken nose.
You know, every day there's a piece of the story that keeps coming out. We, last night on CNN, we talked to an ear witness who heard the scuffle and heard this going on and had a different view of what happened. We heard from the parents. We've heard from Zimmerman's brother and his father. And that each time there are different interpretations. The last piece that came out about the possibility that the lead investigator actually wanted to press charges but was overturned by the state's attorney. So every day they're going to be looking into more and more of this. But let me tell you something that's fascinating, and that is how this story has galvanized America. On Wednesday, I was speaking to my kids' fifth and sixth grade class. It was career day. Mm-hmm. They had me come out. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to know about CNN and journalism. But they spent most of their time, these are sixth graders, talking about the Trayvon Martin case. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed how much detail they knew. They knew about the Skittles. They knew about the iced tea. They knew he was walking to his dad's fiance's house. And that the passion that this has galvanized. I sat with the parents who were here in town this week at an event Wednesday night, and I was just amazed at how much they have stayed calm and focused throughout this whole ordeal.
Brian Munro, hold it right there. There's a big learning curve on Trayvon Martin. We're looking at that and a lot more in this week in the news. 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, on Tuesday, those passengers on JetBlue Flight 191 had to hold down the raving pilot. JetBlue passenger and former corrections officer David Gonzalez spoke to ABC News.
He started to curse at me and, trying to tell me, hey, you better pray, Iraq and Iran. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to show you what Iraq and Iran is. And I took him on a chokehold.
The influential feminist poet Audrianne Rich died on Tuesday at 82. Here she reads her poem, Solfeggetto, about a mother teaching her daughter piano, about youth counting the minutes to freedom.
Shelving ambition, beating time to on the ice at Sweetbriar or the sunken cathedral for a child, counting the minutes and the scales to freedom.
And banjo legend Earl Scruggs did this week at 88. He forever changed the way banjo is played. Here's his Foggy Mountain Breakdown with Lester Flatt and the Foggy Mountain Boys. Looking at a week in the news, health care before the high court, budget talk on Capitol Hill, the Trayvon Martin story growing in that JetBlue freakout. You can join the conversation. Who's got the right approach on the federal budget? Who's got the right approach on looking at this Trayvon Martin case and how it should unfold? What about the president on the open mic? Russia, is Mitt Romney right? Is Russia still necessarily our big enemy? And what do you make of that scene on the JetBlue flight? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK with Louise Radnofsky of the Wall Street Journal, health policy reporter there. Brian Munro of CNNPolitics.com and our own Jack Beatty. Here's another sound of this week. Well, several here Monday. Protesters, as they have been doing day after day, but here gathered on the steps of the state capitol building in Atlanta, Georgia, to demand justice in the death of Trayvon Martin. Here they chant, arrest Zimmerman now. In Florida, on Wednesday, State Attorney Angela Corey appeared on Florida's WJZT radio show, The First Coast Connect, and said she's planning to conduct a thorough investigation of Trayvon Martin's death.
All we're asking for is patience so that we can conduct the full investigation that Governor Scott has tasked us with and also be able to give Trayvon's parents the answers they deserve.
Rising impatience for that arrest, but also defenses of Zimmerman this week. Joe Oliver, a close friend of the Zimmerman family, African-American, former CNN anchor, has been speaking out in defense of George Zimmerman. On Sunday, on ABC News Good Morning America with Dan Harris, Joe Oliver said he didn't think Zimmerman was racist.
You have known him for quite a while.
I've known George since he started dating his wife.
So about a decade. And in your view, is he a racist?
I have never seen anything to indicate that.
Brian Munro, here we are. Now we've got the attorney in Florida saying she's not going to talk about it anymore. Just give us some time here. We've got to work on this. Where does this stand? What's happening? What is legally happening as people wait for some kind of move one way or another on this?
Well, I think the next big legal window will be April 10th when the grand jury is supposed to convene, and there's a whole bunch of protests and organized around the country. Folks are calling on folks to wear hoodies that day. So that's probably the next big window. But throughout the next few days, you're going to see more and more pieces come out from people who were either witnesses or who were connected somehow to this case. But even, again, across the country, we saw this week where someone had inadvertently tweeted out the wrong address for what they thought thought was George Zimmerman living in Florida, turned out to be an elderly couple that wasn't even connected with the case. And even Spike Lee retweeted that address. Spike then came out and apologized, and we found out that he has since reached out to the family and offered to pay their expenses for all the trouble that he and others caused.
So this story is
all over the place.
I mean, that seemed kind of irresponsible for somebody with so many followers to put out an address. It's not them. Their lives are totally turned upside down. On the other hand, people are really upset here. And Jack Beatty, here we are, the whole country watching this, and now we've got this contest, this battle of narratives going on. You know, was Trayvon a sweet kid? Was he not a sweet kid? Was George Zimmerman a racist? Was he not a racist? It would be good to get down to what actually happened there and, you know, get away from just the PR battle, Jack.
It would indeed, and that's why I think this audio tape is so important. It's now being investigated by the new state's attorney. And who is calling for help in that? You know, Zimmerman people say it was Zimmerman. Trayvon's parents say unquestionably it was their son. It seems to me that'll go a long way to put an objective stamp on what happened, or at least what seemed to have happened. What I'm troubled with is the way Mr. Zimmerman, understandably, has come out defending his son and saying, you know, that the president and others are, quote, creating a climate of hatred. I really don't see that. I mean, I don't see how the president simply saying what struck me as an extremely moving and revealing moment, this could have been my son.
If I had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin.
Yes. I don't hear hatred in that. I hear identification. I hear empathy. And I don't think it helps to make that kind of extreme claim. And on the, you know, on the farther reaches of the right, there are now this talk about the Black Panthers somehow involved in this. And an effort to sort of say, you know, to kind of racialize this in the other direction. So it's an ugly business.
It does seem like there's some danger on exactly that front here. People are worked up. William in Nashville, Tennessee. William, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. You're on, William.
Okay. I might think that anyone who's drawing conclusions one way or the other definitively about Trayvon Martin right now is being a racist. I think there's not enough information for anybody to draw an adequate conclusion about what really happened, and it's clearly a two-sided coin. And what's happening is people that are on one side are identifying one way and going further and further to the left. People on the other side are going another way and further to right. I've heard both left and right call-in stations, people going crazy directions. Mm-hmm. And I think it is fundamentally racist and incorrect for people to draw any conclusion at this point. The parents have a right to feel the way they feel, but I think we should all pull back, let them actually investigate it and get the true facts before anybody says what should or shouldn't happen to either of these men.
William, let me just ask you on that front then, what about the fact that the young man died, but George Zimmerman wasn't arrested? Now, we may come to some, you know, really good, thorough conclusion here about what actually happened eventually, but it is a fact that as of right now, George Zimmerman still has not been arrested. Is it? Do you think it's racist to think?
If he were standing there with a gun in his hand when the police walked up wiping blood off himself, that's one thing. Mm. My understanding is that the proof shows that he had been assaulted himself by the man he shot. And whether that's a valid basis for the shooting or not, I'm not saying. But that leaves a reasonable doubt as to what you have to determine about arrest.
William, I appreciate your call, and we've got it. And of course, we don't know what the proof is here at this moment. And on the video, we see him kind of jauntily almost walking to the police station. But there's the call from our caller, Brian, to say, let's wait for all the evidence to be collected here. How do you respond to that, Brian?
Well, here's the piece that I think we're all forgetting. Remember, nothing happened 2 weeks from the event. This happened more than a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
For the first 2 weeks, this was considered a closed case.
Closed case,
that
yep.
It was done, and it wasn't until the parents and, yes, the media, the Orlando mm-hmm. Sentinel, CNN, and others, mm-hmm. started making noise about this. That that didn't even, you know, it's our fault as the media for not even focusing on that for 2 weeks after the event. That, you know, this caller and others wouldn't even be having this conversation mm-hmm. had it not been for the attention paid 2 weeks or 3 weeks after this event happened that was thought to be done, a done deal. Oh, my goodness, just another black man shot in Florida.
Yeah, Trayvon would be dead, George Zimmerman would be free, and that would be that without people really saying, hey, wait a minute, Leon in Charleston, South Carolina. Leon, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to look at it from a different perspective. If Trayvon Martin, being 17 years old and saw someone following behind him, Will the stand your ground law apply to him in defending himself against George Zimmerman? And I like to take my answer, hear my answer off the air.
Lee, and I appreciate that. Now, that's an interesting question. He's another citizen of Florida. The same law applies to both. If he felt threatened, Brian, what about Trayvon Martin and his stand your ground rights?
Well, you know, I'm not even sure where the Florida stand your ground law applies in this case. There are a few facts that aren't really disputed. One is that Zimmerman called 911 after spotting Martin walking down the streets. 911 told him, stay in the car, stay in your vehicle. He chose not to. He got out of the vehicle and started walking towards Trayvon. Those facts are undisputed. Also, we know that from Trayvon's girlfriend, who was on the phone with him at the time, and she said Trayvon told him, someone's coming towards me, said that at that point was when he put his hood up, according to her. And then they were talking as he was trying to avoid this interaction, and then the phone went dead. Those are things that we know. And then we know, of course, that Trayvon was shot and killed, and it's not disputed that that was at the hands of Zimmerman. Everything else, folks are trying to piece it together.
But it is an interesting perspective Leon brings here, because George Zimmerman walked, presumably, because of the stand your ground law. I mean, otherwise, there's a dead young man on the ground. He couldn't walk without that. But
I think it's pretty clear that this would never have happened had Zimmerman stayed in his vehicle.
But there's the question of, you know, what did Trayvon Martin feel? Did he feel that he was being threatened on that night in the rain? Bert in West Palm Beach, Florida. Bert, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. My point is, being involved with New York City Auxiliary Police for 20 years and also with Palm Beach County Sheriff COP program, we know that if we see something suspicious going on, our responsibility as the eyes and ears of the department was to report this to law enforcement, call the dispatch, follow the instructions of the dispatch, back off, wait in your vehicle, wait till law enforcement arrives, describe the individual, give them directions,
yep,
tell them where he is, and then let law enforcement handle it. Unfortunately, Mr. Zimmerman, for whatever reason, decided to take this responsibility on to himself.
Even though the police, and we can hear them in the 911 tape saying, don't follow him, just wait there, we'll send police. Burdick, sounds like you've got experience of this, and maybe you would have stayed in the car. He didn't, and here we are. We're talking about a big week in the news, from the Supreme Court to the Trayvon Martin case and right on beyond. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me get one more on the Trayvon Martin front right here. George in Bowling Green, Kentucky. George, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in time, the tactical side of this, of the consequences of this law, will play out. My question speaks to what I think is a larger issue, and that is holding people accountable for the genesis of the law. Because as I understand it, the 26 states that have passed it were all lobbied in common by NRA to have this law put on the books.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, the NRA needs to be accountable for the role they played in creating this incredible tragedy.
Well, that is an interesting perspective. I appreciate your call, George. Jack Beatty, I mean, you've paid a little attention to this, how it came to be that so many laws now have this, so many states now have this law that can create, if it's not really a carefully followed, a kind of Wild West situation.
Yes, and the NRA played a key role, but so did something called ALEC, the American Legislative Executive Exchange Council. I beg your pardon. This is an organization that essentially took language virtually identical to the Florida law and supplied it to legislators in a score of other states where this has either been passed or is a law similar to that have even been passed or are being contemplated. As you look into ALEC, this institution, it is supported by corporations, by Coca-Cola, for example, by AT&T, by others, by the Bail Coalition, which wants to have people, you know, being charged, and supported, of course, by the Koch brothers, who are, in general, givers to these kinds of things.
Why would big companies care if we had a stand-your-ground law out there or not?
Well, according at least to the conjecture of Paul Krugman, and I identify that as a conjecture, the idea is that if it helps conservative lawmakers stay in power, it's good for conservative interests. And certainly in the narrow sense, it's good for the penal industrial complex, the bail coalition, the guards unions, others. So there's a strange kind of business connection, or at least a fringe business connection, to this whole story.
Let's look for a minute abroad. We'll be back to Trayvon Martin, I have no doubt, and of course to health care. But President Obama was abroad this week. He was in Seoul, South Korea on Monday. Had a kind of open mic moment where he didn't know the microphone was on. He was talking with the Russian president, Medvedev, and caught on mic talking about, hey, give me some flexibility here. I've got an election coming up.
This is my last election, basically.
Yeah,
after my election, I have more flexibility.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand. I transmit this information to Vladimir. I understand.
After my election, I'll have more flexibility. The presumption there that he's talking about the missile system in Europe, and maybe more than that, and Medvedev saying, I understand I'll transmit this to Vladimir, as in Putin. Mitt Romney jumped all over that with a bigger characterization even of the U.S.-Russia relationship. This was with CNN's Wolf Blitzer criticizing Obama for that open mic comment and expressing concern about the relationship and saying that Russia remains one of our greatest enemies.
This is, without question, our number one geopolitical foe. They fight every cause for the world's worst actors. The idea that he has some more flexibility in mind for Russia is very, very troubling indeed.
Brian Moore, you're following politics here. The president's saying, give me a little time here and we can be more flexible. Mitt Romney jumping on Russia as a campaign issue. Does that sell in this country today, Brian?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see if whether this will backfire against Romney for putting Russia as enemy number one against the U.S. right now.
But what about backfire on the president for saying, hey, wait till after the election, we can do some business?
What do they say in D.C.? It's amazing when the truth comes out. I think this that may have been how the president feels and got caught on an open mic. And oddly enough, I think if you look back a few years ago, George Herbert Walker Bush made a similar comment on an open mic, and I think it was even about Russia. And so this is how the game is in Washington, that there are what is said publicly and then what happens privately, and sometimes those streams cross.
And, Brian, a quick politics check here. Newt Gingrich cutting his staff big time this week. Paul Ryan has endorsed Mitt Romney. I don't know where Rick Santorum stands. We've got more primaries coming up, Wisconsin and more. How's this thing sorting out in the primary side, Brian?
You know, Wisconsin is going to be really important for Santorum, and he's not doing well right now. It's such a steamroll for Mitt Romney. He's gotten the Rubio endorsement. He got George Bush Sr. It looks like that Romney and Newt Gingrich had a secret meeting last week, and of course Gingrich is now cutting his staff by a third, got rid of his campaign manager, and maybe dialing back his intensity, even though he continues to publicly say he's taking this all the way to Tampa. But this is Romney's to lose right now.
So watch this space. We didn't even get to the budget moves in Congress, but we are going to hear a lot more about that over the summer. Great to have all of you with us today. Brian Munro with CNNPolitics.com joining us from Washington. Thank you so much, Brian, for your insights today.
Thanks for having me.
Louise Radnofsky, health policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for joining us, Louise.
My pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, always great to have you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.